So yes, for the last 5 years, I've been trying to explain to people that I am indeed trying to write a novel about trees. Brad's eyebrow was not the only one lifted by that explanation. I guess another way to tell this in a soundbite way would be to say it's actually the story about nine people, very different backgrounds and characters, who have to learn that there is an enormous cast of supporting characters who make their lives possible, who have made them who they are, both biologically and culturally, and have to learn to take seriously enormous, long-lived, incredibly powerful, social, complicated, supplely behaved creatures who shape their atmosphere and filter their water and create their soil. And at the end of the day, learning that makes them learn to think about human beings in a different way. The segment that I'm going to read today happens at about the one-third point of the book. It involves two characters who Brad referenced, Olivia, the raised from a near-death experience college party girl who gets transformed into a visionary, and the man who she drags along in her wake, the older, somewhat bemused and bewildered Nicholas Houle, a kind of art school flame out who's been living by himself in the Midwest for several years. They have ended up in California at the time of the Timber Wars. The section that I'm reading depends a bit upon a story somewhat similar to the Pacific Lumber Real World story, for those of you who know. It's essentially the consequences of a Texas junk bond financier buying up a family lumber business that had been run sustainably for a long time, deciding to gut the inventory as a way of paying off the debt that he incurred in order to buy the company and pass along the bill to the American public in the form of various dicey financial instruments. So in an attempt to stop the destruction of this one last small bit of old growth redwood in the area, a number of activists are taking to sitting in the trees. And this is a form of resistance that had been practiced many hundreds of times in the area. And the two characters, Olivia and Nicholas, are about to undertake their first tree sit. It sounds as if there are four people involved. That's because Olivia and Nick have taken the forest names Maidenhair and Watchman. So it sounds like a bridge game. It's actually a cribbage game. So the two of them are just now arriving at the enormous redwood that they're going to be sitting in for a bit longer than they realize. They slog the last few hundred yards up the rut. Maidenhair, their watchman. Maidenhair, watchman, and their guide, Loki, who has run ground support for this tree for weeks. A profile emerges out of the thicket, so huge it can't be right. There it is, Loki says. There's Mimas. Sounds come up out of Nick's mouth, syllables that mean loosely, "Oh, my hopeless Jesus." He has seen monster trees for weeks, but never one like this. Mimas, wider across than his great-great-grandfather's old farmhouse. It runs straight up like a chimney butte and neglects to stop. 25 feet above ground, a secondary trunk springs out of the expanse of flank, a branch as big as any eastern tree. Two more trunks flare out higher up the main shaft. Watchman humps up to where Maidenhair stands gazing. Even in the falling light, her face glows with cause. All the agitation has drained away. replaced by a certainty as pure and painful as an owl's call. Her face tilts up the Titanic trunk. I can't believe there's no other way to protect this thing except with our bodies. Loki says, if nobody's losing money or getting hurt, the law doesn't give a fuck. The base of the tree between two enormous burrows opens onto a goose pen large enough to sleep all three of them tonight. Soot marks run up the trunk, the scars of fires that burned before there was an America. And from high up in the tangled mass, vanishingly far above ground, come the cheers of two exhausted people out of their element who just want to be dry and warm and safe again tonight for a few hours. Something tumbles down from above. A rope dangles in the air, the width of a watchman's index finger, in front of a shaft wider than his field of view. What do we do with this? Attach the packs? Loki chuckles. You climb it. He produces a harness, loops of knotted rope and carabiners. He starts to put the belt around Watchman's waist. Hang on. Are these staples? There's been some wear. Don't worry. Staples and duct tape won't bear your weight. No, this little shoestring will bear my weight. Olivia steps between the bickering men and pulls the harness around her own waist. Loki clamps her in with carabiners. He cables her to the climbing rope with two sliding prussic knots, one for her chest and the other for a foot stirrup. Stand up on the stirrup, push the chestnut as high as you can, lean back and let it take the weight. Then sit back into the harness, slip the stirrup knot as high as it'll go, then stand up on that, repeat. Maidenhair laughs, like an inchworm. She stands up, she leans back and sits. She stands and inches again, climbing a ladder of air, hoisting herself in self-raising footholds off the face of the earth. Watchman stands underneath as she scoots into the sky. The intimacy, her body writhing above him, makes his whole soul flush. She's a natural, Loki says. She'll reach the top in 20 minutes. She does, though every muscle in her is shaking by arrival. From above, cheers greet her summit. Down at ground level, jealousy seizes Nick, and when the harness drops again, he springs into it. He gets about 100 feet in the air before freaking. The rope can't possibly hold him. It's twisting and making weird nylon sounds. He cranes his neck to see how much farther. Forever. Then he makes the mistake of looking down. Loki twirls in slow circles below. Nick's muscles surrender to panic. He closes his eyes and whispers, I can't do this. I'm dead. He feels the zoom, the endless drop coursing through his legs. Two small lumps of vomit come up his throat and onto his windbreaker. But Olivia is talking, close up in his ear. Nick, you've done this already. I've seen it for weeks. A hand, she says, a foot, sit, slide the knot, stand. He opens his eyes on the trunk of Mimas, the largest, strongest, wildest, oldest, surest, sanest living thing he has ever seen. Keeper of 500,000 days and nights, and it wants him in its crown. Shouts greet him at the top. Those above him fasten him with clamps into the tree. Olivia scampers about the platforms along a rope ladder. Buzzard and Sparks have long since talked her through every clause in the lease. They want only to be gone before night traps them. They climb down the rope to Loki, who calls up through the encroaching dark. Someone will be by with your replacements in a few days. All you need to do until then is stay aloft. Then Nick is alone with this woman who has commandeered his life. She takes his hand, which has still not unkinked from gripping. Nick, we're here, in Mimas. She speaks the creature's name like she's been talking with it for a long time. They sit next to each other in needle-grazed darkness, 200 feet in the air, on what Buzzard and Sparks called the Grand Ballroom, a 7-by-9-foot platform made of 3 doors bolted together. Sliding tarp walls shelter them on 3 sides. Bigger than my room at college, Olivia says. Nicer. Balanced on another branch just beneath is a smaller piece of hardwood. A rain barrel, collecting jar, and sealable bucket complete the bathroom. 6 feet above them on a higher spur, another platform serves as pantry, kitchen, and den. It's filled with water, food, tarps, and supplies. A hammock stretched between 2 limbs cradles a substantial lending library left here by previous sitters. The whole 3-level treehouse balances on the top of an enormous fork made when the trunk was hit by lightning centuries ago. It sways with every breeze. A kerosene lamp illuminates her face. He has never seen her look so confirmed. Come here. She takes his wrist and guides him to her. Here, closer. As if farther away were an option. And she takes him, like someone who's sure that life has need of her. In the night, something warm grazes his face. Her hand, he thinks, or the fall of her hair as she leans over him. Even the slow, seasick barcarolle of the sleeping bag bed feels blessed, the cramped quarters of love. A claw cuts into his cheek and the succubus lets loose with falsetto gibberish. Watchman bolts up, screaming, shit! He pitches toward the platform edge, stopped by the safety cable. One palm punches through the fantasy tarp of walls. Lives go shrieking off into the branches. She's up in a flash, pinning his arms. Nick, stop, Nick, it's okay. In the hail of chatter, he's slow to hear what she keeps saying. Flying squirrels. They've been playing all over us for 10 minutes. Christ, why? She laughs and pulls him back down horizontal. You'll just have to ask them if they ever come back. She nuzzles him, her belly in the small of his back. Sleep won't come. There are creatures that live so high up and so far away from man that they've never learned fear. And thanks to the humanity in his cells, Nick has, this very first night of his very first tree sit, taught them. Light gathers in speckled fistfuls on his face. He has slept almost not at all, but rises refreshed in a way normally reserved for the industrious. He rolls onto his side and lifts the tarp. The whole spectrum streams in, from blues to browns, greens to absurd golds. Look at that. Let's see. Her logy voice breathes in his ear. Oh, goodness. They look together. High wire surveyors of a newfound land. Cloud, mountain, world tree, and mist. All the tangled, rich stability of creation leaves him stupefied with silence. Reiterated trunks grow out of Mimas's main line, shooting up parallel like the fingers of a Buddha's upraised hand, recouping the mother tree on smaller scales, repeating the inborn shape again and again, their branches running into each other, too mazy and fused to trace. Fog coats the canopy. Through an opening in Mimas's crown, the tufted spires of nearby trunks stand swirled in a phantasmagoric Ordovician fairy tale, It's morning, like the morning when life first came up on dry land. Nick sweeps back another wall of tarp along its rope runner. Dozens more feet of mimas unfold above. Trunks that took over when lightning clipped this one. The top of the tangled system disappears into low cloud. Fungi and lichen everywhere, like splatters of paint from a heavenly can. He and Maidenhair perch most of the way up the flat iron building. Below, the floor of the forest is a dollscape a little girl might make out of acorns and ferns. His legs go cold with the thoughts of plummeting. He lowers the tarp. She's staring at him, madness in her hazel eyes that spills out as cackling. We're here. We made it. This is where they want us. Here and there, solo spires rise above the giant's chorus. They look like green thunderheads or rocket plumes. Only now, 70 yards above the ground, can Nicholas gauge the true size of these few old ones, 5 times larger than the largest whale. In the middle distance, the forest broadens into denser, deeper blue. On every side, trees lap at the low, wet sky. The clouds they themselves have helped to seed. Skeins of aerial needles sip the fog banks, condensing water vapor and sieving it down the sluices of twigs and branches. The land unfolds, ridge beyond ridge. His eyes adjust to the baroque abundance. Forests of 5 different shades bathe in the mist, each one a biome to creatures still to be discovered. And every tree he looks on belongs to a Texas financier who has never seen a redwood, but means to gut them all to pay off the debt he took on to acquire them. A shift in the warmth next to him reminds Watchman he's not the only large vertebrate in this roost. If I don't quit looking, my bladder's gonna burst. Olivia scrambles down the rope ladder to the platform below. Nick thinks, I really should look away. But he's living in a tree 200 feet above the surface of the planet. Flying squirrels have surveilled his face. Fogs from the world's infancy turn the clock back eons, and he feels himself becoming another species. She squats above the wide mouth jar, and a stream rushes out of her. He has never seen a woman urinate, something a fair number of human males who've ever lived will have to say on their deathbeds. The ritual concealment suddenly seems like some strange animal behavior that might turn up on a BBC wildlife documentary, like fish that change sex when they need to, or spiders that consume their partners after mating. He hears that received pronunciation whispering off camera. When removed from their kind, individual human beings can change in remarkable ways. When she's done, she tips the jar over the side of the platform. The wind takes the liquid and disperses it. 20 feet and her waist atomizes into the fog. Needles will rework it into something alive again. My turn, he says when she comes back. And then, from above, she watches him crouch into the bag-lined bucket, which will go to Loki for removal and compost when he shows up next. They take breakfast al fresco. Their chill fingers feed hazelnuts and dried apricots into mouths that hang open, awed by the view. Sitting still and looking, their new job description. But they're humans, and soon enough she says, let's explore. The main trails from the grand ballroom are laid out with loops and lobster claws, rope ladders, places to hook a carabiner into. She gives him the harness. Then she makes one for herself from 3 nylon climbing cables. He wobbles out onto a waving branch. The wind blows, and Mimas's entire crown dips and bucks. He'll die. Plunge 20 stories onto a bed of ferns. But he's getting used to the idea, and there are worse ways to go. They head off in different directions. He inches along one barrel-sized limb, cabled in, scooting on the seat of his pants. The scraped branch smells of lemons. One twig holds a shock of cones, each smaller than a marble. He takes one and taps it on his open palm. Seeds fall out like coarsely ground pepper, stuck in the crease of his lifeline. From such a speck came a tree that holds him 200 feet in the air without flexing. This fortress tower that could sleep a village and still have room to let. From high above, she calls out, "Huckleberries, a whole patch of them up here." Bugs swarm, iridescent, party-colored, minuscule horror film monsters. He works his way to a strange junction. Two large beams over the course of centuries have flowed together like modeling clay. He grapples to the top of the hillock and finds it hollow. Inside is a small lake. Plants grow along a pond flecked with tiny crustaceans. Something moves in the shadows, speckled all over in chestnut, bronze, black, and yellow. Seconds pass before Nick coughs up a name. Salamander. How did a damp-seeking creature with inch-long limbs climb two-thirds of the length of a football field up the sides of fibrous bark? The only plausible explanation is that his ancestors got on board 1,000 years ago and rode the elevator up for 500 generations. Nick edges himself back the way he came. He's propped up in the corner of the grand ballroom when Maidenhair returns. She's ditched the safety umbilical. You'll never believe what I found, a 6-foot hemlock growing in a mat of soil this deep. Jesus, Olivia, were you free climbing? Oh, don't worry. I climbed a lot of trees when I was little. She kisses him, a quick, preemptive strike. And you know, Mimas says he won't let us fall. Nick sketches her as she copies her morning discoveries into a spiral notebook. The drill of solitude comes so much easier for him than for her. After years of camping in an Iowa farmhouse, a day at the top of this Leviathan flagpole is like stepping out. She, though, in her core chemistry, is still a college girl, addicted to a rate of stimulations per second that she hasn't entirely kicked. The fog burns off. Deep in the expanse of midday, she asks, "What time would you say it is?" Her question is more mystified than agitated. The sun hasn't passed overhead, and yet the two of them are worlds older than they were this time yesterday. He looks up from sketching the local labyrinth of Mimas's limbs and shrugs. She giggles. "Okay, what day?" Soon enough, an afternoon, half an hour, a minute, all feel the same size. Just crossing the 9-foot platform is a national epic. More time passes, a tenth of an eternity. 2/10. When she speaks again, the softness shatters him. "I never knew how strong a drug other people were. The strongest, or at least the most widely abused. How long does it take to detox?" He considers. "Nobody's ever clean." In the hammock library, she finds a book, The Secret Forest. "Would you like me to read to you?" She reads like she's in the front of the assembled class, reciting that long freight train of stanzas from Leaves of Grass that the entire 10th grade was assigned to memorize. You and the tree in your backyard come from a common ancestor. She stops and looks out the transparent wall of their treehouse. 1.5 billion years ago, the two of you parted ways. She pauses again, as if to do the math. But even now, after an immense journey in separate directions, that tree and you still share a quarter of your genes. Tacking into the breeze of the author's thought, they make their way through 4 full pages before the light starts to fail. They eat again by candlelight, instant soup mix floating on 2 cups of water, warmed on the tiny camp stove. By the time they're done, darkness rules, filled with the 1,000 spectral challenges of night that they cannot decode. "We should save the candle," she says. It's hours before bedtime. They lie on the long, rocking platform of their pledge, chattering to each other in the dark. Up here, they face no dangers but the oldest one. When the wind blows, it feels like they're crossing the Pacific on a makeshift raft. When the wind stops, the stillness suspends them between 2 eternities in the caress of here and now. In the dark, she asks, "What are you thinking?" He's thinking that his life has reached its zenith this very day, that he has lived to see everything he wants, lived to see himself happy. "I was thinking it's going to be cold again tonight. We may need to zip the bags together." "I'm down with that." Every star in the galaxy rolls out above them through the blue-black needles in a river of spilled milk. The night sky, the best drug there was before people came together into something stronger. They zip the bags together. "You know," she says, "if one of us falls, the other's going with." "I'll follow you anywhere." They wake before the light to the sound of chainsaws in the deep beneath them.